Well, thank you, Arnold. As usual, you've given me something to hang my hat on. When he mentioned détente, I reminded him, I think yesterday, that détente is a French word, but it has a double meaning. It means, of course, and that's the way we use it, or some people use it in this country, meaning relaxation. But the other meaning of détente is the trigger of a gun, from which the word in English comes, from detonation. And the great difference, I think, of some people who fell for détente was they really believed in the possibilities of relaxation with the Soviet totalitarian world. But the Soviets, I don't think, ever believed in that. And to put it in a different way from Goldie Meyer, they, in effect, in practice, not in word, were practicing the idea of détente as the trigger of a gun. The second thing I'd like to point out, or like to mention, to open this up in terms of some of the remarks I will make, is I ran across in the article in Foreign Affairs, I think it's in the last issue, by Adam Newlam, who I think is the outstanding man in this country, doesn't get the publicity of others, in writing on Soviet history, Soviet foreign policy. And he recalled, he wrote an article, I think it's in the last 40 years, of the problems of Soviet-American relationships. And he started out with a quotation from Lord Melbourne, who said some years ago, 19th century, I believe, on the Irish question of all things, he said, "What wise men had promised has not happened. What the damn fools predicted has actually come to pass." And then he went on to write the article to deal with the post-war period and all of the problems which still remain, basically problems which overshadow all international questions today, namely the East-West relationship. And I don't believe that you can discuss basic foreign policy today without relating to the global East-West situation. It's unfortunate we use these words East-West, especially in terms of the East being the Orient and so forth, but I think we know what we mean between the concept of a totalitarian world that we're dealing with and a democratic world. The third thing I'd like to say is that, you know, and it leads in to what I'm going to say, it's been more than 40 years ago that I came to Dallas. I came here during the short period I worked in Washington before going overseas later on in the War Production Board and worked on aircraft. And I came here the end of 42 for the construction of the aircraft plant, Consolidated. And I recall that because that came a year or so after the speech of Roosevelt in his answer to Pearl Harbor, when he said, "We will build 50,000 planes a year." And of course, he was poo-pooed by Mr. Hitler. What I'm trying to emphasize is at that time, when he made that speech, the United States was producing 6,000 planes a year with 2,800 workers in the aircraft industry. In 2.5 years, we went to the production of over 100,000 planes a year with more than 2.5 million workers in the industry. But the difference between then and today is we had time to do it. We had the time to do it because Britain, as Churchill and Roosevelt said, was a stationary, land-based, in the island, in water, aircraft carrier, which permitted to hold off the Nazis, especially during the Nazi-Soviet Pact, to give the United States, with the productive power, to come to the position where they could eventually win at least the military aspect of the war. Today, if such a thing would happen, we would not have that much time. And it's a serious question which is being raised by many people. I don't think I am competent to judge of the respective arguments. But there's a great issue involved, and that is why, in spite of what many people may say, in criticism of the American labor movement today, especially certain groups within the American labor movement, we have not basically changed our position on attaching fundamental importance to the needs for security and for the defense of the United States. We may differ on the percentage of the budget, and that has been a legitimate difference now, whether you're conservative or liberals. These labels, conservative and liberals, and right and left, don't really impress me anymore. And I always remembered the famous joke in France before the war. Why is French politics the way you spell the name of Laval? Because from right to left, or from left to right, it's the same damn way to spell it. And in terms of attacking this problem, of attacking this issue, whether it's a Democratic, Republican, what you call a conservative or liberal, the basic problems remain in America because of the nature of our society, the nature of our problem. We went from the Nixon administration and Mr. Kissinger with his detente policy, and actually, and I am not a great defender, and George Meany was not a great defender of the opposition to Mr. Nixon in the campaign, if you remember. He declared himself neutral, since he could not vote for Mr. McGovern. But the point is that it was later, after we had disarmed ourselves during that period, and I am not saying we disarmed ourselves, Mr. Kissinger, after he was out of government, in a famous speech in Brussels, said, "Never in the history of the world has a power like the United States unilaterally disarmed itself." And then it was, if you like it or not, in the Carter administration that the build-up, the rebuilding of a bigger budget, a bigger army, big armaments, even he went, but then lost his nerve, for the neutron bomb, but then pulled it back. It was the greatest mistake he made, first in offering it, but then multiplying it by taking it away, because Helmut Schmidt, the Social Democratic Chancellor at the time, accepted the neutron bomb. But that was rejected. But the buildup for that started during that period. And it was interesting for me the other day, some weeks ago, to hear Edward Teller, who I regard as not only a great scientific mind, but a great political mind, with a sort of Hungarian twist, which is always very important, recalling the testimony of Harold Brown, a Democratic Secretary of Defense, when he was being questioned at the Congressional Committee. His testimony, he was presenting his increased budget and for all the things that they wanted to do, including, I believe, at that time, the neutron bomb and other instruments, also the new bombers, and also in the field of missiles. And one of the senators said, "But Mr. Secretary, if you do that, then the Russians, the Soviets, will up you, increase over and above, and it becomes a race. And Harold Brown said, yes, that is true. If I say this, they will do that. They will say that. But let me add the second point. Even if I don't do what I'm proposing, they will continue to do what they want to do, which is to build up their military organization. Now, when I say that, I do not believe that we are on the eve of a nuclear war, or we are on the eve of the kind of thing that we faced in Pearl Harbor. I believe still, that may change, I believe still the Soviets conceive that they can win what they want to win, which is eventually, in one way or another, the domination of the world through political warfare. And here, I always recall what Lenin did in his remarks, in his books, in his dictums to his party, in changing the wording of what Clausewitz, the great Prussian military historian, said when he said, Mr. Clausewitz, war is a continuation of politics by other means. Lenin stood it on his head. He said, for us today, politics is a continuation of war by other means. And I believe in facing the Soviet Union, we are facing not just a nation like other nations, not just a regime like other regimes. We are facing a totalitarian regime which is dedicated to eternal, permanent conflict. They have conflict within their own society, and I don't minimize the tremendous weaknesses within the Soviet Union, with a society which has been a failure in terms of even what they originally claimed to be their objectives. But no one should take consolation in the fact of the internal weaknesses of the Soviet Union, because they are dedicated, when Nano referred to the penetration of unions and the attempt to take over unions, they realize that if they can do that, they have one of the most important instruments in their hands to paralyze and to destabilize any other society from their point of view. Because they have no illusion. They had no illusions in 1946 and 47, when we were fighting them in the streets of France and Italy, that they could take power. Because they knew then the American army was there. But what they did believe is that they could prevent the democratic powers from being stabilized, from being able to rule. And this was their major objective. And therefore, I would say there's only one half of the story to say that the unions are instruments that the Soviets can use. I want to say it's within the trade union movement that the battle against them goes on, where today, as against 30 years ago, they do not control what they did control at that time, the trade unions in France and Italy. And with all our differences with Italy and France today, they're so far a better ally than a number of other allies that we have in terms of the problem of security and defense. Because it's a socialist Mitterrand who said, pacifism is in the West, but the missiles are in the East, and has supported not only the program of the United States in terms of security, but they themselves are perhaps not in NATO, but in practice, one of the best assets we have if we ever come to that eventuality of an important military force. I know they've had problems recently as a result of Greenpeace and the mishaps of their touted intelligence agency. But it is within this labor movement where we believe, with all the shortcomings, that the battle has taken place and where they have lost ground in the last 30, 40 years, that they have gained ground in certain places. But I'm talking now in terms of control of the labor movement. I'm not too happy about our differences with some of our trade union friends, and I speak frankly in terms of their East-West relationships and regarding the unions of the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe as being legitimate unions. But in terms of dealing with the communists, in terms of their internal organizations, there is no question that the record of the trade unions on this question is much better than some of the gentlemen in business. And I am not a fanatic in terms of putting everybody in the business world in the same group. But anyone who has read Joseph Finder's book, The Red Carpet, will find something to think about the relationships between our great businessmen, our great bankers, and the relationships with the Soviet Union. Here is Mr. Oscar Hammer being...
Arminhammer.
I'm sorry. Arminhammer, Occidental, who's being feted and dined by queens and by presidents, including this country, as a great man. In the history of that family, he, and especially his father, who was Julius Hammer, who started the whole business with Lenin and the Bolsheviks. And if you read some of the Lenin books, some of the letters, you will see the orders he gave to the Ministry of Commerce for treating very nicely Hammer when he comes there. That same Julius Hammer was one of the founders of the American Communist Party. And I believe that it is a rather ironical thing to read in Joseph Finder's book, with that marvelous title of one of his chapters called One Karl Marx Place. That's the address of Chase Manhattan in Moscow. And secondly, we had to protest in a demonstration against Jaruzelski before the United Nations with President Wayne Kirkland speaking there. And that day or another day, David Rockefeller was giving a luncheon for Mr. Jaruzelski, the man who instituted martial law and who crushed the movement, which still lives, and we still work with, believe it or not, with Les Valenza. But a movement that I should recall to you, and this is pertinent to the issues of security and peace, and whether you can have peace movements, or whether you can have East-West relationships on peace and disarmament, things like that. The Solidarnosc, in their first Congress, not only had a resolution, not only in their 21 points, had a point on freedom association, but had a special point calling upon the Polish government to reduce their military budget. And so I said to, I won't say my communist friends, but my communist adversaries in the ILO and other places where I meet them, especially the Russians, when you talk about peace, the day that you will permit in Eastern Europe what Les Valenza wanted to do, and you will permit that in the Soviet Union, then we can talk about peace. We can talk about going together. But as long as freedom and human rights are suppressed, that's as long as we don't believe that really there is a chance to coming to an agreement on some of these basic issues. Because certainly, this business that you have to coexist, we've been coexisting. You can't do anything else. Neither one is going to attack the others. You go through the motions, and you have to go to conferences in Geneva. And I don't believe this business of getting acquainted is the answer to the problem. And I don't believe that you would get excited every time a new man comes in the head of it. And I don't mean that there aren't differences, but we must stick basically to dealing with the problems of how we cope first with what you have referred to about the attempts of the communists, because they are free in the free world to try to penetrate and infiltrate. How do we cope with it? Because we haven't spent much time on this question of political warfare. And we are engaged in political warfare, wherever you go. There is no peace. There have been at least 100 wars since World War II. Without nuclear weapons, with old-fashioned classical weapons, and getting it from the arms trade from any possible country, along the Russians, especially the Russians, who are the greatest suppliers of arms, especially to the third worlds. And until we are able to cope with what I call the two-tier approach of the Soviets, they are both a government and they are also a non-governmental force operating in any other non-governmental agency, organization throughout the world where they're free to do it. And they are free to do it. They are free to come to this country and get on the television.
No worries.
But this problem of engaging in political war, of going to bat with the communists, as we're doing in Nicaragua, as we're doing in Salvador, it's the American labor movement that is backing the anti-Sandinista forces. And of course, I think in a certain sense, Borga and Ortega have given us a gift in what they have now come out in the open to say what they're doing, what they were doing all the time. But we must use these things. And I have said some months ago in a meeting with some diplomats in the United States and other countries, and I got up and said, trouble you people is you don't know, the Soviets really are losing. But we in the West don't know it. But the Soviets know it. And that's why they're winning. Because the Soviet Union has been losing. And they could be losing more. If we would engage in supporting the forces that are fighting against, for example, the Soviet invasion in Afghanistan, who would support the forces in Angola and Mozambique, like my old friend Savimbi. And it's a long story that goes into this whole question of the engagement in political warfare. I know perhaps these are not terms that you should use publicly, but there are other terms to be used. But essentially, what I would say today is, there's no question of where we stand on security. And with 1 minute, I will give you 1 point which I think sums up our position. We regard the principal threat to the security of our alliance, and we regard the Atlantic Alliance still with all its faults, and it's the oldest alliance. I mean, its alliance has lasted longer than any other alliance since the treaty in the days of the Greeks in 477 BC. The principal threat to the security of this alliance has its origin primarily in the nature and existence of the Soviet totalitarian regime. The totalitarian and aggressive nature of this regime is the root cause of this insecurity. Does not mean that we wouldn't have any problems if the Soviet regime would change tomorrow, but we would not have the kind of basic permanent threat that we have to peace in the world. Any evolutionary change in the Soviet dream would make it more possible to achieve a more peaceful global harmony. Without internal change in the Soviet world, it is doubtful that there can ever be an agreement in the near future on some of the burning issues of our time, namely real disarmament, peaceful coexistence, economic cooperation, and international order where respect for human and trade union rights would be guaranteed. And for us, we cannot discuss peace, we cannot discuss in Geneva without bringing up the issue of human rights and the right of people to have freedom of association and freedom of press and freedom to yell and scream and to disagree with their government, especially on military questions as well as on political questions. That, in a nutshell, is our position.